I would love to see the Utah Royals incorporate some of the orange of Southern Utah into their uniforms.
Rather than just have an America First slogan plastered across the front? Wouldn't that be nice?
Slate us, big boy.
Hello, and welcome to Expected Own Goals, a Tale of Two Teams edition. I am your host, Eric Morgan.
I'm Evan Davis. Yes, we are doing Utah Royals as part of our ongoing season preview week. And joining us is none other than the impresario of American soccer analysis, our old buddy, Kieran Doyle Davis. Hi, Kieran.
What's going on, gentlemen?
I heard you got some news.
We do. ASA announced a deal that's been going on for a while, that we've been helping out Minnesota United in MLS with their recruiting and overall analytics projects and such. It's a really, really exciting time for everybody at ASA. Also, the previews this year, the written previews are going to slap for NWSL. We have easily the most talented NWSL lineup we've ever had. But I wanted to put it out there because I know people in the league listen to you guys. You guys are the pod in the league now. If people are interested in analytics projects and whether they don't have the people power at their club or they kind of don't know where to start from an analytics perspective, ASA is doing stuff with clubs now. If you want to reach out, I think the email is inquiries@americansocceranalysis.com, but you can reach out through these gentlemen at the pod if you so choose. But I just wanted to put that out there because it is a thing we are doing now, and I think there's a lot of appetite for it in the women's game especially.
I spoke with somebody with the Columbus Crew Analytics Department when we were at the American Soccer Insight Summit in Houston last month, and I asked him, be real with me, how good is G Plus really compared to what you can get on the back end as a member of a team? And he said, it's really close. And so if you are listening, front office member, GM, sporting director of an NWSL team, and you feel like you need to find a way to get an edge and can do it on a budget, no better people to call than American Soccer Analysis. They are industry innovators for a reason. And they're the only ones with the guts to put all this stuff, or a lot of this stuff, in the public domain. So trust them, because we trust them. This all started a year ago with this guy when we launched our partnership with ASA. So if you trust us, that means by extension, you trust ASA. If you want to get good and you want to get good quickly, you could do a lot worse than bringing Kieran and his team on board. For the purposes of today's discussion, we enjoyed having Kieran on for this one because he did Utah with us last year. And I went back and I listened to that episode and we were pretty down on them. When you pull back the lens, 2024, 25 expected points against 25 actual points, 13th in the league. But there was a real before and after that occurred that we didn't necessarily anticipate. Amy Rodriguez getting the boot the end of June. Jimmy Kunratz coming in, Kelly Cousins seeming to assert a little bit more authority over the roster, and the team looked kind of interesting. One of Kieran's compatriots, Chloe Lacasse, turned into a player I don't know if I've ever seen her be before. Kieran, what was your reaction to the way that Utah's inaugural season unfolded?
It's funny. I went back and looked, and I was like, I think I was like pretty negative, but I also think I said, maybe A-Rod's going to get fired. I asked how long her leash was, and we were all like, no, it won't happen. And it happened, which is quite funny.
Fucking happened.
I think the thing that stands out the most to me, particularly because of how last season went, is how big that before and after is. Like, I pulled up some of the numbers explicitly at the split.
Night and day.
Amy Rodriguez fired at 8 points from 15 games, minus 20 expected goal difference. The rest of the way, they run -2 expected goal difference, 17 points from 11 games. If you look at their rolling XG plot, it goes from like the deepest of red, which is bad, to reasonable, like fringe playoff team. And the reason it stands out to me so much is that's exactly what Orlando was. They had a horrible start in 2022. And then the back half of the year, they were a surprisingly competent team. And I totally slept on that split heading into 2024, so 2023, 2024. You know what I mean?
We all did.
And so I was surprised. Now, talking about previewing 2025, I don't think they have added nearly the talent that Orlando did.
No.
I don't know.
There's a great interview we've referenced on this pod a number of times that Theo Lloyd Hughes, friend of the pod, did with Kelly Cousins, where she's just talking about how she envisions building a club. It runs almost directly contrary to the way Amy Rodriguez envisioned it. And it sort of feels like maybe Cousins was just waiting around for A-Rod's hubris to get the best of her and for the wiser minds to eventually see a middle path of progressive improvement. They sort of shockingly improved against the talent that they had. Do you feel like that's an overperformance in the second half of the season? Or do you think they were pretty much playing to the talent on hand?
I think they probably played better than the talent. So if you look at their G plus distribution by players, of their top seven players by G plus with greater than 500 minutes played, four of them joined in the back half of the year. That's Lacaze, Zornoza, Tejada, and Tanaka. Lacaze is going to be out for the entire season, right? Like she did her ACL in October. So like probably not going to come back at all. And those players are good, but they're all also older. So part of it, I'm like, maybe that is actually just their talent level. If you asked me to project their talent for this year, I would not have them as a roughly zero expected goal difference team for the season, I don't think.
When we checked in last year and we're talking about the acquisitions that they made, Evan and I thought of them as stopgaps or like mild improvements, stabilizing forces, like adding ballast to your team. And then Zornoza went out and had like a pretty singular set of performances as a deep-lying playmaking defensive midfielder that really unlocked a lot of other things. And Lacaze overperformed, and Tanaka was Tanaka, which is a pretty good pro. The real question is how much evolution we're going to see, and we should probably just get right on to it. Evan Davis's longtime bugaboo, Ali Sentner. When we look at Ali Sentner's numbers, how real is the hype versus how pessimistic should we be about her?
Evan, where's your Sentner hat? Because I'm curious to see where you are a year in to her career.
Look, she's a dribbling whiz. We know she's a dribbling whiz. It's quite obvious whenever you watch her. Jimmy Kunratz posted on social media after she scored her screamer against Colombia with the U.S. He posted something to the effect of like, oh, and people want her to shoot outside the box less. And like, what's so funny is like, she's not even the best outside the box shooter in the league. And she wasn't the best outside the box shooter in college. She just did it the most. Like, she scored three outside-the-box shots from 35 shots in her final year at UNC. She scored two from 42 shots in the NWSL. That stinks.
She ran, like, negative on her finishing.
Yeah.
Last year. Like, three. It was three goals from, like, 4.5 XG last.
Well, and also, like, if you look at what she is expected to do, like, this is her, like, her signature skill. This is the thing that has, like, made her bones in college and in the pros. Like, I'm looking at, like, the outside-the-box conversion rates, which, you know, don't take these seriously anyway because they're so noisy thanks to small sample, but, like, she converted less than 5% of her shots from outside the box. That is laughably low when you compare her to, say, Vanessa DiBernardo, who converted 10%, or someone who didn't take a lot of them, but Ashley Hatch converted 12.5%. Again, these numbers are all meaningless, but if you're going to look me in the eye and say that this is somehow a sign of this player's value and their quality, I would at least expect them to be overperforming this noisy metric. And she doesn't. So what is it going to take to convert that dribbling into production actually inside the box? Because the scary part is she's not that much of an outlier on her dribbling relative to other wingers, and her receiving's in the toilet. Even if you take out like a couple of the outlier events and like get that number shrunk a little bit and a little bit tighter, she's still a net negative. And that's where you really start to worry about how she is going to maintain any level of productive consistency in the years to come.
Can I play devil's advocate? I don't think I agree with what I'm about to say, but like this, I think is the case. Utah had like a real ball progression problem. Like they just could not sustainably get the ball up the field. If you look at their team receiving numbers, they're just garbage as a team. You have Zornoza for a whole season now. You trade for Alex Loera, who's coming off of also a serious knee injury. Like we'll see where she's at. You can paint yourself a picture of, okay, they're going to more sustainably get the ball up the field. She's not going to have to receive the ball deeper compared to her positional peers. And if that player goes from, okay, I'm receiving with six players behind the ball to I'm receiving with three players behind the ball, or I'm receiving in situations where it's much closer to a 1v1, you could talk me into her being a more productive player. I sort of feel similarly about Alyssa Thompson. I think she thrives more in transition than Centner does, but you could see a world where, like, okay, if you could sustainably get her into really high quality 1v1 chances, she's so good as a dribbler, there's something there. So, again, Centner is not as quick or as useful as a dribbler. But I think that's the case, is like, we're going to get you the ball higher up the pitch more frequently and in better spots than we did last year. Again, I don't think I believe that. She is also very young. Like, player improvement is a real thing. Who knows what off seasons look like? Maybe going and being around legit pros with the national team is a huge thing for her. I don't know. But that's the argument I would make if I was really, really into
it. I think that there is a certain amount of perception is reality. And if Ali Centner's long shooting ends up causing defenses to swarm her and create space for other people, there's a certain amount of keeping defenses honest that actually might be required. I don't think it requires you to lose 40 possessions on 42 shots or end up with a handful of corners on 42 shots. There is something to a reputation mattering in terms of what you can do to defy that reputation and be productive as a team. Like, Ali Centner keeping a team honest can stretch a defense.
What I will say, if I'm going to swap sides, I'm no longer the devil. I'm back on the good side.
By the way, that is devil's advocate. I'm mostly anti this.
Is that that's only true if she becomes a legit threat as a passer, which she has not shown yet.
She's mildly positive, but she's not like dazzling.
That said, she spent the better part of a season with her only real passing option being Hannah Bedford,
for sure,
who couldn't finish to save her life. So how much faith was there in the quality around her for the Amy Rodriguez era?
So this is where the devil's advocate argument collapses. It collapses on two fronts. One, UNC in the autumn of 2023, relative to its competition, had a very strong midfield. Guess what Ali Centner did a whole bunch of times that year? In fact, burnt 32 possessions on missed shots from outside the box. So that's one thing. The other thing is, I took a look at other age 20 attackers or teenage attackers take their oldest season if they hadn't already turned 20, just from the last few years, players who had logged at least 50% of their team's minutes. So in other words, a Centner type, a player who was young, inexperienced, but was still being trusted with a pretty large volume of responsibility. Just looking at their XG plus XA per 96 minutes, she's the worst of this group. And this group includes Sophia Wilson in 2021, Trinity Rodman 2022, Deanna Ordonez with North Carolina in her rookie year, Michelle Cooper's rookie season, Ebony Salmon with Louisville's first season, Mal Swanson with Washington in 2018, Livia Moultrie and Alyssa Thompson last year. She was the worst in terms of chance generation for herself or for others. And so if she is continuing her habits, when she had relatively better teammates from her college days, she's continuing those habits into this year. And she's not even getting the benefit of generating chances for others or chances for herself elsewhere on the field. You know, for example, Sophia Wilson, legendarily shot happy player from outside the box. Guess what she did in her rookie year? Almost 0.7 XG plus XA per 96. You know, if you want to make the argument about bad team with bad teammates, there's no trust there. Well, Ebony Salmon logged 1,350 minutes with Louisville and put up 0.43 XG plus XA per game. Ali Centner is 0.31 in that respect. Even if there was better talent around her, which I've heard people make the argument like, oh man, if Bethune and Centner swapped teams for their rookie seasons, they would have had each other's season.
No.
Which is nonsense. Like, Centner with good players or bad players just seems to be this kind of player. And so I don't know if getting better attackers or getting ball progressors behind her helps her here.
You know what's funny about the Bethune one is that was a legitimate criticism that I heard from multiple teams ahead of the draft was like, yeah, we don't know if she can adapt her game to the pro level in terms of shot selection. That was like a big thing that I heard from multiple teams were like, ah, I don't know. And then she goes into a really high level pro environment and plays a little bit differently than she did in college and is wildly productive, whereas Centner's like, nope, I'm doing the same thing.
I went back and watched all 35 of those outside the box shots from UNC and then watched a bunch of her outside the box shots with Utah. It is crazy how similar they look to each other. Getting the ball at the edge of the final third, the Maisie cut inside dribbling, and then all of a sudden there are three, four defenders in front of her and she just pops one. It's this same pattern over and over again. That's the thing that really drives me crazy.
I do think some of this is coachable. The concerning thing is that Konrate's tweet where he's like, yeah, just rip. You know, like people tell her not to take giant rips, but I want her to just rip it. That to me is more concerning than just saying like, hey, Allie, let's see if you can't get 3 yards closer, 4 yards closer for your average shooting location. Like, let's set a goal and see if we can't just get you better shots.
I'd love to sit next to a coach and make them watch all 77 of those long range bombs and have them tell me, was this the right decision? Because I'll accept the idea that maybe you just had to get a shot off because the defense was collapsing and maybe you didn't have support runs going on. I can accept that. But across 77 opportunities, can you really say that every single one or even a majority of them, Centner made the right call in shooting from 18, 20, 25 yards out? I'm pretty skeptical.
I genuinely think it is the single most coachable skill in attackers from an analytical perspective. Like, it is the lowest hanging fruit is improving shot locations. It is so much like you said, Eric, like it is, hey, you're dribbling in from the wing. Like, can you work yourself an extra 2 yards? Because if you think about it, that extra 2 yards towards the middle of the pitch is like an extra 2% on your shot. And if you take 50 shots a season, that's a goal. Will you do this small thing to score one extra goal every season? And it's very easy to sell players on that. At the same time, when this player is supposed to be like the jewel of your franchise, I imagine there are pressures to that of like, well, I don't want to, you kind of have to let them have some things. And I wonder now that he's the full-time coach, like, again, people just say things. I would be very curious to see if he is okay with this in 3 months' time.
2 points in her favor. A, she put up ridiculous, very small sample, but ridiculous non-penalty XG plus XA per 96 in the She Believes Cup per game, led the tournament in doing that. Scored one screamer, but also scored a pretty great cutting run in the box. I think the little coaching adjustment that you give her is those extra 2 yards, that might create a shot. That also might create time for another runner or a pass. Allie, we just want you to like continue to have multiple options in possession. And so taking that extra beat of time to see if Mina Tanaka can run off a defender and slip in and create a better goal, that's what those 2 yards mean. If you're going to get those extra 2 yards a little more central, think about also all the other knock-on things that benefit our team and our ultimate goal of winning games.
Let's figure out the rest of the attack here, because it's a lot of running it back. Paige Monahan's back. Brekka Mazingo's back. Brekka Mazingo really had a rookie year to forget. You'll have Mina Tanaka for an entire season, and then you have a player that Eric and I have been intrigued by for quite some time in Aisha Solorzano coming over from Tijuana. Even when you strip out a lot of the noise of her data, granted it's from Y Scout, you just focus on the games against Chivas, Pachuca, Tigres, and America, and Rayadas. If you just focus on the big five there, she still looks like a pretty, pretty good, solid striker. But it will now be a third half season in a row where Centner's going to have new teammates to adjust to. So what do we think about the teammates around Centner? Does Solorzano go straight into the 11? Does Mazingo get another chance? Is Monahan the expected starter? How do you balance playing time between Solorzano and Tanaka? What are we thinking here?
First off, there is no type of signing I like better if you're going to go from international pools than a player who put up massive numbers on a not traditionally powerful team. And like at Tijuana, that's what Solorzano did. And she did it with like subpar talent. It's not dissimilar from like, they are dissimilar players, but it's not dissimilar from like Kundinanji just doing everything.
That's exactly the name I was just thinking of.
or Kouassi at Fleury. You know, like I love a player that does it on a team where they kind of have to do it and puts up sort of outlying numbers. I assume there's going to be some sort of adjustment, but I kind of think that Solorzano is a different enough style of striker from Tanaka that you could potentially play them together in partnership. Maybe Tanaka's a little bit deeper and facilitating more. But I think this is like one of those Utah problems that's very agreeable as opposed to other depth chart problems like maybe North Carolina with Ashley Sanchez and Jaden Shaw, where you're just like, I don't know how these two players get along.
I'm probably more skeptical about Liga MX's Femme transition than I think you guys are. I just don't think there's very much. Like, you look at the roster and you look at the additions and it's like I really don't think there's enough. Even if you say the second half of the year is the real Utah and there's something like a zero expected goal difference team, like, okay, great. You were able to run a half season at that. Can you run a full season at that? I look at the additions, like Loera is helpful, but she's coming off of a knee. I know like the college people really like Mia Justice coming from Texas, but Mandy McGlynn was great last year. Like, it's not like she's going to win that role right away. I was kind of surprised that they gave up on some of the younger squad players they had. Like, I don't think Hannah Bedford is great, but like, and she can't finish, but she's an objectively useful off-ball player. Like, if you told me she's going to crash the last 15 of games and chase and run behind, like, sure, useful. Zoe Burns, I think, is like an odd one to move on from.
Yeah, that was crazy to me because that would have been a very cheap re-signing.
Exactly. Cameron Tucker wasn't exactly like prolific, but she was an almost league average winger for a pretty terrible team. Like, I just, those feel like fringe players that you could have kept for very little. Why would you not? You know what I mean? And like, they're not good enough that these moves around the edges are the difference between some ultimate goal in this. But I just think when you don't add a huge amount of talent, like I made the Orlando comparison earlier, like this is not a team who added Barbara Banda. Like, you kind of actually do absolutely have to nail every single move everywhere to get somewhere.
I think the one thing that scares me about this team is, are there better candidates for regression than Zornoza and McGlynn in this league? You've got a 34-year-old central midfielder with sub 1,000 minutes of data on her. And then you have a goalkeeper who stood on her head and was excellent. But like, if Mandy McGlynn is a league average goalkeeper, how many points does that cost you at the end of the year? This is a team that I think the bottom, yeah, probably could fall out of.
Yeah, I think you could say the thing about Tanaka too, which is also a big concern, because I think you are expecting Tanaka to provide a fair amount of the scoring responsibility when Centner is popping off from long range, or if Solorzano isn't able to translate from Liga MX Femenil. So I think that for me, there is such a like mushy bottom right now in the NWSL, where there is a bunch of clubs who kind of aren't great or maybe even very good, but each has varying degrees of interesting yet possibly high variance pieces. And I think the thing that has attracted me to Utah, despite whatever rant I went on about Centner, is that like there is something there with Solorzano. Like there is something there with maybe getting a full season out of Tanaka if she can play like she does with Japan. There is obviously a ton there with Loera despite the knee stuff. Can I say the same for like a Louisville or a Seattle? You know, even a Houston who made even flashier signings in a lot of ways. And I took something to heart with Centner when I spoke with her at Media Day in Beverly Hills a couple months ago, where she said when they were under Rodriguez, she didn't use Rodriguez's name. Like she said, man, they were really searching for structure. They were really desperately like scratching around for any kind of team structure on the field. And she felt like they got that with Kunratz. Maybe that's enough to at least get you sniffing around that bottom playoff spot. You're not necessarily going to be playing a home game in November, but with the way that San Diego's roster is looking, the way that Louisville's roster is looking, the way that Angel City's roster is looking to some extent, it might be enough, especially if you can get some of these signings to hit on the higher end of their percentile of outcomes.
Yeah, drag Portland into that mix too now.
Absolutely. Like, sure.
I think the one thing that I find encouraging, having just said these are regression candidates, I'll now advocate for the fact that Kate Delfava, Alex Loera, if she plays center back, and Claudia Zornoza is a really, really solid defensive triangle with a deep-lying midfielder and two center backs.
Do you think that's a thing? Loera center back?
They've talked about it. Yeah.
She did do that at KC, right? Yeah, I forgot about that.
The idea that has been floated is potentially moving Loera centrally next to Delfava and then using Ana Tejada as the destroyer and allowing Zornoza the freedom to get further upfield and move the ball up, or flipping Tejada and Loera, making Loera the destroyer and pushing Tejada back. From what I can understand, Kunratz likes the idea of that level of flexibility and the ability to get Zornoza on the ball in more interesting areas of the pitch than she sometimes found herself last year. So I think that's the thinking. How it's actually going to look is another question. Yeah.
So what's funny is if you look at kind of where the split comes from, like as we've spoken about, once Kunratz comes in, like the metrics all massively improve. It's like a lot of defensive improvement.
Again, structure.
Yeah, exactly. When you make that comment about structure, in a league with so much parity, it is really important to not get away from the fact that, like, if you are organized and competent defensively and don't give away goals, you give yourself a chance in every single game. When you talk about like teams who are maybe not that good, but there's the variance case, if you play a lot of close games, just takes bounces
or long range alley center bombs.
Only under the most dire of circumstances. But yeah, I mean, I think like if you can get McGlynn and Delfava to at worst hold serve, if you can get Tejada and Loera functioning in the way that makes the most optimal sense after having seen them in preseason and maybe a couple early games in the season, and you sort your fullbacks out, which is maybe an interesting question we can lead to because we haven't talked about Tata Malazzo coming over, then all of a sudden, like you said, you sort of have a decent base on which to build. And then eighth or ninth kind of sounds more reasonable. As far as the fullbacks are concerned, they brought over Nuri Robano from Wolfsburg, who had not been getting playing time. Intriguing numbers, if you strip out some of the noise of being in the Frauen Bundesliga. Tata Malazzo coming over from Chicago. And then players like Madison Pogarch and Olivia Smith-Griffiths, who bore a lot of the responsibility in wide defense, and neither of whom were particularly good. Pogarch was kind of a disaster. Does Malazzo go straight into the 11 there? Do you give Robano a chance to win the job? Do you trust Olivia Smith-Griffiths to maybe shake off some of the young player rust? Like, where on this depth chart do people float to the top?
I'm pretty curious about Ana Maria Guzman, too, because I was thinking, like, what if you had, again, if we're talking about ways for the structure is going to give you the defending, how do you get a little bit of extra attacking juice? Like, let's say the base is the four of Zornoza, Tejada, Loera, and Delfava. Like, however they arrange them, that's the four. Is it like you go with a really aggressive fullback and the other fullback's pretty conservative and that's your base? None of the fullbacks move me that much. But like, I look at Robano and I look at Guzman and you're like, all right, maybe you could like fling one of them up and send Centner a little bit more central. I thought, as you mentioned earlier, she was reasonably positive as a passer. And I think if I was someone giving her advice in her life, I think that I would be like, hey, you should totally lean into the 10 things you do rather than the like wide forward things you do. I think there's much more scope for you to have like a really impactful career there.
It's kind of what she wants to do anyway. Always cutting inside.
Well, and now it's like, can you be that player in the pockets and create as a passer? But I think if you imagine she becomes that more tenny player with a high fullback, you could maybe get yourself part of the way to talking yourself into a reasonable attack.
Okay, Kieran, you're Jimmy Konrads.
Yeah.
What is keeping you up at night? What is the one thing going into this Utah season that you are anxious about?
Can we score enough goals? It's 100% that question. Can we score enough goals? Because I think like, even if you're confident about the structure, like, which I think he should be, I just look at it and it's like, am I going to have to give some of that up to score enough to win enough games, especially in what is a comparatively short season in terms of number of games? Like, wins are hugely outsized. Like 3 points is three times more than one, which is an obvious thing to say. But I look at it and I think that's the number one thing I look at.
That was how Chicago snuck in last year, right? They were terrible, but they won just enough games against bad teams to make it work. Okay, prediction time. Where are they finishing?
10th.
I have them, because of Portland's relative implosion and just not being moved by any roster around them, in 7th.
Whoa.
But I also don't think 7th and 10th are that different in this league this season. I think there's a very clear top three, and then maybe a very clear next two. And then it gets kind of mushy. In that mushy place, I feel like Utah also has money to spend, which is potentially really important by the time we run around in summer, should they want to. But like, they are a lot less cap hurt than a lot of the teams around them, bar Louisville, who just don't spend money. I think 7th is a reasonable place for them.
I brought up Chicago a second ago. Chicago was genuinely bad last year, especially in the back half, even on results, not just on performances. They still got to the playoffs. 8 playoff slots in a 14-team league, especially with the stratification in talent that we saw last year, which was so unusual, and maybe that isn't in place anymore, but it kind of feels like it is, means that you don't maybe need to be the most scintillating squad in order to get to the first round. And so for me, I think that there is potential upside in attack that could allow them to score enough goals, provided the defense is what we think it could be, to sneak in to the dance. So I have them 8th.
If you look at that, I think entirely the difference is like 3 goals more that you guys think Solarzano will score than I think she will score. Like, I think that's the whole difference.
Those are the margins. Absolutely.
Now I want to ask the question, 90th percentile outcome for Utah this season, 50th. We've all sort of said what our 50th is. And what is the 10th percentile outcome for Utah this season?
I think their ceiling is low, like for the same reasons that we're like kind of hesitant to really go there. I don't know, if everything went really right, you got quite fortunate with finishing luck and maybe some other injuries elsewhere, like 6th maybe. Like, I certainly think there are exceedingly few outcomes that they crack into the big 4 teams. Like, I think there's zero world where that happens.
Yeah, I mean, 90th percentile, I think is 6th is about right. And I think 10th percentile is 13th.
I would be surprised if they were the worst team in the league, I think.
Yeah, no, Chicago exists, so.
Yeah, that's right. Having picked them to go 7th, I'm slightly more encouraged by them than basically every team that they are in league with. But getting a home playoff game feels like outside their grasp. So I agree. 6th. If Bay or Gotham collapsed, 5th is the 90th percentile. But it requires other things to happen. And then I think their basement is potentially the basement of the league, or 13th, because Chicago exists. So I agree with you.
If you think about it, if you say a 90th percentile outcome is they score 10 more goals, how far up does that really move them? Whereas if they score 10 fewer goals, it's like, oh no, they're in real trouble.
Yeah, they're in deep shit. And that's exactly it. It's like 10 more goals gets you maybe to 5th. Gets you a 6th, 5th, and 10 fewer goals. Jimmy Kunreitz doesn't have a job. If prior behavior is a predictor of future behavior, Utah is not giving coaches long leashes here. So if they're dramatically underperforming and not scoring goals, I don't think it's a particularly long leash. Kieran's a mensch.
Such a mensch. And as you heard on the show, ASA has partnered with Minnesota United to consult on building up their data component of recruitment. And they are open for business for any NWSL club who might like to consult with them. So if you are a GM or somebody who works in the front office listening to this, I really hope that you reach out to Kieran and his team, because ASA is an industry leader in so many ways.
Not to like overplug this to the very specific GMs listening, my experience of ASA is rarely are you in the company of people who are A, extraordinarily smart, and B, extraordinarily open-minded and humble about the work that they do. So those two components, I think, make ASA a brilliant person for any club to partner with if they're looking for an edge. you will get not just incredible insight, but you will get people who are constantly experimenting and trying out new things. They are right on the cutting edge.
1,000%. It's the reason that we partnered with them in the first place. So go out and do it, folks. In the meantime, you have two other previews to listen to in your feed today. One on Angel City with Sporting Tribune's Michelle Chavez and Angel City Sporting Director Mark Parsons, as well as an episode on Racing Louisville with none other than Becky Morgan of NWSL this week. So go and have a listen at those. We'll be back tomorrow with Chicago Stars FC and Bay FC, so keep an eye out for that in your feed. In the meantime, follow us on social media at X-Zone Goals. That's the letter X-Zone Goals. Rate us, review us, follow us, tell your friends about us, do all the things you're supposed to do with podcasts. Email us at expectedowngoals@gmail.com. That's the letter expectedowngoals@gmail.com. For $6 a month or $60 a year, you should join our Patreon and get 4 exclusive bonus episodes every single month, including access to our Discord, as well as access to our YouTube live stream. So click the link in the show notes for that. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll speak with you tomorrow.
Bye.